Before we get into tonight's show, I want to remind everyone that at 8:30 this evening at Concordia University, room H435, Professor Peter March, the St. Mary's University logic professor, who at the time of the Muhammad cartoon affair, in the face of academic and administrative pressure, put up those cartoons on his office door, spoke up for free speech, will be lecturing on Islam and democracy, the urgency of reforming statist faith at, as I said, 8:30 Concordia University, room H435, and I encourage all our listeners to go there. We hadn't planned this show to coincide with the Auditor General's report on the liquor board, but it's fateful, and properly so, that it occurs on this day. The Auditor General was damning in his report. He said the public got screwed, which they did, and brings into question the whole concept of why government interferes in things that has no business interfering. People want to buy and sell liquor. Why do they does the government have to intervene? Why does the government determine where and what we smoke, how we drive, whether little Johnny can sit on a bicycle with a helmet on, or frankly, which another issue which we'll be discussing later in the hour, how doctors and other professionals regulate their lives, and how much freedom of expression and association and assembly, which is our natural birthright, we're allowed to have. The man who set what's been called the neoconservative revolution into motion 25 years ago passed away last week. Milton Friedman was an economist, but he was more than an economist. His economic views, though free market, concentrating largely on money supply, had more to do with ensuring personal freedoms than ensuring anything else. In his seminal 1962 book, Capitalism and Freedom, Friedman wrote, "The proper question for any citizen is not to say, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. But the free man will ask neither what his country can do for him, nor what he can do for his country. The right question," said Friedman, "was what can citizens do through government to, quote, help us discharge our responsibilities and, above all, to protect our individual freedoms." To discuss Friedman's legacy and to discuss the political ramifications of the Friedman Revolution, which really took hold under President Reagan, we're glad to have with us a friend, Thomas Velk, professor of economics at McGill and chair of the North American Studies Department. Good evening, Tom. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Beryl. Nice to be here.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, on this question of the liquor board, I'm sure that Milton would say that if you have a great big government, you inevitably tempt people to do the kind of wickedness that is in all of our hearts. So there's all this money, all this power flowing around in government. It's no surprise that people abuse it. You would increase public morality by diminishing the scope and power and monetary influence of the state.
The question of the liquor board that has rarely been asked. I mean, it's been asked by some commentators. It's been asked here by Jim Duff, myself, and a few others, but really not enough, particularly not in the print media, is why the heck does the government, do we have this remnant of the recidivism of the blue law legacy of the 1920s? Why should the state be controlling liquor at all? Why don't they control food, for that matter? If it's just to tax the bottle, they can tax the bottle in a grocery store.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting, of course, that when the state does get into one of these businesses, they very often get into the business that is, you know, widely viewed as the more corrupt or the more wicked or the more evil. I mean, governments run the gambling casinos, they run the booze parlors. I suppose
at the same time they insist on lecturing to the public on what their morality should be. Tom, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with you.
Okay.
And for cell users, it's *940 for Rogers and #940 on Bell. And we're talking to Professor Thomas Velk, McGill economist and chair of the North American Studies program. We're talking about government intervention in the state, in our lives, state intervention in the economy, and the legacy of Milton Friedman. Tom, the extract I read from Capitalism and Freedom, does that about sum up what Milton Friedman was about?
Well, he's a very interesting guy. I have immense respect for Milton and his legacy. But, you know, he was far from being at the very leading edge of the people who criticized the state. The guys who were really at the front of that wave were a couple of guys called Hayek and von Mises. They were the head of a group called the Austrian School. Milton still had a great, I don't know if he personally had much respect for government, but he was a savvy enough politician to criticize the government insofar as saying the government did things in a foolish way. When he wrote his great book about the history of American monetary policy, he blamed the Federal Reserve System, the American version of the Bank of Canada, for making the Depression worse. But then when he, instead of saying what the Austrians said, which is what we, which is that we should get the government out of banking altogether, he just had a better plan.
Now, just for our listeners, basically in layman's language, Friedman was saying that that when the government issues too much money and there's too much money literally sloshing around, that doesn't help the situation at all. And Hayek's work, particularly in the Constitution of Liberty, was the basis for the Thatcher Revolution in Britain, rolling back state involvement in every aspect of people's lives.
That's right. It was really Hayek and these Austrians who I think are more responsible in a kind of a subterranean way, a less advertised way than Milton's strategy, for the rollback of big government. Milton was ahead of himself when he talked about social things. I mean, he was quite a libertarian. He advocated, for example, the legitimization of drugs, or at least the removal of drugs from the list of serious crimes. He advocated removing the state from education to a large degree by using school vouchers and so on. So you could send your kid, if you wanted to send your kid to a religious school and use your own tax dollars to do it, you could do that and so on. But when he talked about monetary things, he really said, as you have suggested, that, well, the government should still run the banks and control them and regulate them, but it should do so in a more sensible way.
Tom, I want you to stay with us because we're gonna be examining, as I told you earlier, the whole philosophy of how much we can roll government out of our lives, because everything they seem to be touching seems to be turning to waste. And we're just going to be joined right now by Dr. Gaétan Barrette, who's the president of the Quebec Federation of Medical Specialists. And we're going to be discussing Bill 37, another wonderful piece of statocratic engineering. Dr. Barrette, welcome to the program. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking with Professor Thomas Velk, who's still with us on the line. We had planned this show about state involvement in our lives and how much it constricts us. We didn't know the Auditor General's report and the SAQ was coming down today, but basically the Auditor's report said the public is getting screwed. Bill 37, which seeks to bring Quebec's medical specialists, to use the government's word, into line, my great shock upon reading this bill was not so much that it sets a wage cap, $100,000 a year less than the national average, but that, firstly, it almost forces citizens to accept the lowest common denominator of services, to expect less, no revolution of rising expectations, but a revolution of lowered expectations. But more draconian than anything, this law basically doesn't even allow doctors to challenge it, publicly oppose it, and if a specialist wants to leave Quebec, the Quebec government has a right to fine them. How far can we allow government to function, and what does this do to the quality of medical care?
Well, number one, motivation will not be there anymore. As everybody knows, we are lacking a certain number of specialists in this province, about 1,000, and we're losing doctors every day. It doesn't matter.
Just so the listeners don't forget, let's just go back not that long ago when Mr. Bouchard was premier, Jean Rochon was health minister, and they forced the retirement of so many doctors, just took them out of circulation just to save money.
Exactly, and I can tell you one more thing. I was caught into that in 1995 when they did that, and at that time there was a big surge in terms of medical technology. You know, for instance, in radiology, that's when the MR units, the CT scans, and all those machines came on. So we didn't have the doctors to do the examination, and at that time, the wait list went for a couple of months to over 13, 14, 16 months. Now everything is again at stake because we are losing doctors who are leaving the province. As I've heard today, I had made an interview in Chicoutimi, Saguenay today, because everything changes for the better, as you know, in this province. two oncologists.
Hey, Quebec's FM.
Yeah, exactly.
That was wasn't that one of Mr. Burris's slogans?
Yeah, Quebec c'est fin. Yeah. Or Maître chez nous was the other guy.
That was Lesage.
Yeah, Lesage, yeah. So, and yeah, Quebec c'est fin was Burris. And two oncologists, two young, just freshly out of the university, trained in Quebec, French speaking, they wanted to go and see how it was in Chicoutimi, and the condition of practices over there was so bad that they are moving, they actually have moved already to Moncton, New Brunswick, because that very rich
Unbelievable.
Province, very rich province is paying their doctors 30%
Unbelievable.
More. Unbelievable.
Dr. Gaetan Barret, Professor Thomas Belk, please stay with us. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back.
Sure.
We're taking on the question of, is it time to say to governments, hey, state, stay out of our fate? And we're very pleased to have with us Professor Thomas Velk, McGill economist and chair of the North American Studies Program, and Dr. Gaetan Barret, who's president of the Quebec Federation of Medical Specialists. Dr. Barret, to get back to this discussion of Bill 37, not only has it lowered expectations of the quality of care, and not only has it depressed the attitude of doctors, but what shocked me last Friday was that Health Minister Couillard, I just do not understand why he's got this reputation for being savvy or credible. He tries to force the specialists back to the bargaining table, yet he says at the same time he will not discuss any of the penalty clauses in Bill 37 or the restrictive clauses. Now, what does he expect you people to do?
Well,
what is there to discuss? This is like the negotiation under the Soviet system. Andrei Gromyko had a very famous line: "What's mine is mine. What's yours is negotiable."
Yeah, absolutely, and that's exactly how we feel today. Everybody is quite upset, and I can assure you that the 8,500 specialists in this province are absolutely upset, and many doctors are thinking about leaving the province because this is exactly as you said. It's clearly insulting. Demotivating.
Does Couillard understand this? I mean, there's been a criticism of Michael Ignatieff, as you know, who's running for the Liberal leadership, that he's been out of Canada for 30 years. Well, Couillard, before he came back to Quebec and ran politically, I mean, he'd been, running a clinic in the Saudi desert for 4 years. Is he out of touch with how badly things have gone in Quebec since 95 in the healthcare system?
I don't know. Clearly, people at government would like to have that stick forever over our heads, clearly, because this is a relationship that we have today. There is no respect. I think doctors do a significant job in this society, and why is it that we deserve such a law when in 20 years of practice, of my practice, the only thing we did was going out for 3 days in 2003, and because we did that, just in case we would think of doing something like that again, special law. I mean, this is really wrong.
Tom Velk.
The unacceptable thing that's going on here is this, one of the many, is this fine that they want to impose on people who pick up and leave. In the first place, it's the sort of thing the Soviets used to do, at least when they were in a generous frame of mind. Otherwise, they would just shoot you if you tried to crawl over the wall
in
East Germany.
Tom, that they shoot you in East Germany, but in Russia first they send you to the gulag before shooting you.
Yeah. But it's even worse than that, because if doctors were, for instance, to stop working for a while just for denunciation and show the public, everybody, that the conditions of practices like the quality of care, quality of beds, availability of beds and stuff like that, if we were to go out and denounce that, well, then we would be fined. So we cannot do what we should do anymore, which is protect the patient.
What do you tell...
Don't you have a right of free speech anymore?
Not anymore. Not according to that law.
Tom, you just anticipated me. Dr. Barrett's time is limited tonight. I want to ask him this question. I want to pose the same question to you after the news break. What do you tell Dr. Barrett? What do you tell young medical students about how to stay in Quebec? How do you advise them?
The answer to that is very simple. I say to everybody, consider all your options, because if things stay that way in Quebec, you will be puppets in this province. You will never be respected as doctors, and certainly not as a significant actor in this society with that kind of attitude. So consider leaving. I would understand. I would leave myself if I were 30 today.
So we've got an Auditor General who today says that the public got screwed by the SAQ. We've got the President of the Quebec Federation of Medical Specialists telling people basically, look, if government doesn't get out of our underwear, you've got nowhere to go. This is not a great outlook. Dr. Gaetan Barret, we thank you very much for your time. Tom Velk, please stay with us. We're going to get to some of our calls. We're going to talk to Michael right after the break. Thanks. And tonight we're talking about the legacy of Milton Friedman, the importance of free markets and how to political freedom, the failure of the model. We didn't coincide with the Auditor General's report on the liquor board, which says basically the public's getting screwed, but there you have it. We just finished with Dr. Gaetan Barrette, the president of the Quebec Federation of Medical Specialists, about the draconian Bill 37. Before we get back to our special guest, Dr. Thomas Velk, who's chair of the North American Studies Department at McGill University, and take a caller or two. I want to remind everybody listening, at 8:30 tonight, Professor Peter March of St. Mary's University is speaking at Concordia in room H435, the Hall Building, on Islam and Democracy, the Urgency of Reforming Statist Faith. Well, Tom Velk, let's speak. Let's hear Vox Populi. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me on board.
Pleasure.
If we remember what was going on in the Warsaw Pact countries, especially in the Soviet Union, what was going on was that street pushers and paper pushers were making as much as doctors. You know,
they're making more here.
So you know, it's very embarrassing when you get a street sweeper making as much as nurses.
It's not even about money. For government to perpetuate its power, it needs to grow itself.
Yes.
It needs more programs, more bureaucrats. We live in a political jurisdiction called Quebec of 7 million people that has 2.5 times the number of bureaucrats that the state of California does, which has the population of Canada.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with that.
To every professional, say every lawyer on the public purse, or you know, legal services, or doctor, professional, or whatever, we've got 3 or 4 paper pushers. You know, it just doesn't make sense. There's this pseudo-communist psychology where I'm entitled with my, hypothetically, I'm entitled with my grade 7 graduation or grade 11 graduation to make as much as a doctor. Who put in 20 years of education.
Let me just interrupt for a second. Tom Velk, what do you tell students when they look at the model of the society we're living in, where the government sticks its finger into everything we do in our private lives, in our public lives, on consumption issues, on monetary issues, and fails miserably and fails often?
Well, there's a real reason for it, and there's 2 famous guys called Gordon Tullock and the James M. Buchanan who explain the story. What they point out is that when you're running a government operation, whether you're selling liquor or running the gambling casino, or it won't be too long, I suppose, before a government's going to run brothels in this town, the guy who's doing the job for the government has the interest of providing this product, the gambling casino, but he also wants to stay in office. He wants to buy favors from his constituents or his customers, and he focuses benefits on this select group, and he wants to spread the costs of what he's doing as widely as possible with a small per unit a charge to the average taxpayer, so the average taxpayer overlooks the corruption that's going on, or isn't important enough for him to fight. You multiply these programs though, because everybody has his vote up for sale, and at the end of the day, you have a government that does everything or virtually everything. It does it all badly because, as I say, these people are interested in keeping themselves in office much more than providing the product, and the aggregate tax burden is overwhelming, and that's the story of Quebec.
And what the public also forgets is not only is it a public premeditated theft of money for the self-aggrandizement and growth of government bureaucracy, but at the same time that they're ripping us off at the liquor board for no reason that they should control it, at the same time that they're controlling the lives of doctors, at the same time that they're controlling the life of little Johnny, they're also protecting themselves in a little bubble by attacking our very freedoms of expression and association. For example, passing lobbyist acts that say that if you're a social activist and you want to talk to an elected official, which is the fundamental basis of any democracy, you got to register, not the elected official staff of 6 and 7. You got to go to a website and register that you're meeting them.
That's right. And they corrupt us.
Because
we are tricked into playing their game because you say, well, I've got this deal going. You know, I've got this tariff. I've got this piece of protective legislation. I've got this thing that protects my language, whatever it is, whatever little thing it is that they use to buy you. They buy your soul.
They make the public feel like criminals. They make the public feel like criminals, and the public actually gets this mentality after a while, and they think, hey, there must be something wrong if I'm thinking free. Tom, can you stay with us for another segment?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Great. We'll be back right back after the break.
You can email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. And tonight we're talking about, hey, state, stay out of our fate. We've had the Auditor General tell Quebec that the public got screwed by the liquor board. We don't even know why. The government's still controlling liquor. The doctors are getting over the hit over the head with Bill 37 that doesn't even allow them to criticize the law for fear of penalties. They can't even leave the province. We can't talk to our politicians unless you register as a lobbyist because they want to be in a bubble. We're very pleased to have with us, and he's been with us through the hour, Thomas Velk, McGill economist and chair of the North American Studies Department at McGill University. And Tom, we're about to examine another little piece of statocratic engineering, and that's the smoking ban and the court decision of yesterday with Vula Demopoulos. Vula, welcome.
Hi, Beryl.
And Vula, for those of you who don't know, but she's been with us before, is I'll say co-chair or co-president of the Quebec Bar Owners Association that launched the challenge for the injunction. And what stunned me about the judge who refused to grant an injunction is that she said rights are being violated, but she's not going to do anything. She's going to wait for the courts to hear it in May. Now, not only does the state interfere in our lives, keep us from talking to our elected officials, impose restrictions on professionals, take away our ability to buy liquor or anything else that we want to buy, now they're telling us rights are not rights. Your rights may be violated, but we're not going to protect them now. We're going to wait 8 months, let you guys go bankrupt, you bar owners that may want to have a smoking establishment. And, well, you know, if the courts say that your rights are violated, we're real sorry. Is that what it comes down to, Vula?
I guess it's the way it always goes is that the little guy is the one who's going to suffer the most, and it's the small bar owners that are going to suffer, that are going to close down and fast. So, yeah, and I think that although the judge had done her homework and she knew her stuff, it was more or less a political decision.
And that's what stunned me. It wasn't just that she said, well, there's not enough economic damage. She actually came out and said, yes, rights may be being violated because it's not that you guys were asking for the reestablishment of smoking everywhere. You were saying we want the commerçant, the business person, the taxi owner, the bar owner to decide, am I going to be a smoking establishment or not? Take your chance in the free market, in Tom Velk's terms. And yet she said, yes, your rights may be violated. She went past the economic argument. She went to the argument of rights, but said, well, you know, so what? We're going to wait.
Something like that. And even though in the courtroom she was saying things to the government's lawyers, such as, my mother smoked, my father smoked, I'm still alive, I'm still here, you know, I guess that's the way it goes until people make enough noise, like people are going to do on Monday in front of City Hall. It just takes more and more people to make some noise. It's getting out of hand. Last week I heard Rick Peterson say on CJD that in Calgary they've come out with a spitting fine and a fine.
I think that there's a city that came out with a fine for putting your feet up on a bench. Tom Velk, is this what Milton Friedman, when we started the hour talking about him, is this what he meant when he said that when economic freedoms are restricted, as they are by all these laws, political freedoms become irrelevant to the governing authority? Here's a judge who says, well, on the one hand, yeah, there's economic prejudice, but, you know, I'm not really going to deal with the question of rights, even though I know they're being violated.
Absolutely. And of course, what's going on here behind the scenes is the kind of the imposition of a special kind of morality of a wacky kind. Because in this smoking case, it really is, it's not a case of secondhand smoke, because as exactly as you say, you could have in an open society bars that didn't allow smoking and other bars that did. So if you were a drinker and you didn't want to smoke, well, you go to the non-smoking bar. If you're a smoking drinker, you go to the bar that you want. Everybody would get served. What's going on here is that the state has decided that smoking is somehow intrinsically wicked, and we have to be saved from ourselves, or that we're supposed to create a society where this particular and slightly wacky form of civil morality is imposed from above. And that's what Milton feared, and what people like him fear, is that this form of public morality ends up being, of course, the denial of rights, the denial of freedom.
And it's not just denial, it's almost a nullification. Here we have a judge
a judge, a person of the law, who the people who are supposed to guard the line between civility and anarchy, saying, yeah, there may be rights being violated, but, you know, I'm not going to do anything about it. Vula Demopoulos, how disheartened is the coalition right now?
Pardon me?
How disheartened is the coalition, or is there still a vigor to keep on fighting?
There is a vigor to keep on fighting, Beryl, because a lot of what she stated in her judgment just goes to show us that this case is a serious one. I mean, there's a lot of positive to be seen in all of this. One is the fact that she said that, yeah, there is a problem, and it has to be looked at. It has to be confronted. So that is a positive aspect. And the other positive aspect is that she discredited the government's expert witness as far as our numbers are concerned, because our numbers are true. I mean, we had over 300-400 bar owners that gave us their numbers. They divulged their personal information.
Vula, I got to ask you to hold the thought. We've got to go to a short break, but it really is remarkable that the government, you know, is very happy to take $1 billion or $2 billion in tobacco tax dollars. Yes. Smokers pay 8 times the number of taxes into the healthcare system, but they get no rights for it. We'll be right back with Vula Demopoulos and Professor Thomas Velk. And we've been talking this evening on the theme of, hey, out of our fate, thing the gust turns to nothing, whether it's the liquor board, Bill 37, with the doctors lobbying acts that keep that restrict access of elected officials by their citizens, and the smoking ban that is driving people into bankruptcy. Vula Demopoulos, what's the next step? Any demonstrations planned?
We will have something shortly, definitely. We are still raising bar owners' awareness. I mean, they know what's going on. I think that in the next few months, with winter hitting, I think that they're all going to be pretty much panicking a lot and crying the way one of the bar owners was crying last week when we were at court.
I want to bring something else to the public's attention about this anti-smoking law, because we had a smoking inspector in our office building, and the inspector walks in and says that under Article 33 of the anti-tobacco law, they've got a right to search your drawers if you have ashtrays. And I said, oh yeah? Well, under Section 7 of the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms, you don't. So take your pick. Either I call your boss or you leave. People have to understand that it's not just about health questions. It's about freedom questions. Your privacy, your right of assembly, your right of expression. We're running short of time. Tom Velk, if you had to tell your students where North America was going and which direction it should be going in, looking at the kind of disasters we've been seeing one after the other, what do you say as an educator?
Well, it's creeping statism. If they want to be free...
Creeping? It's galloping already.
Yeah, that's right. And what freedom means, is when I do tell them this, is the right... to have an opinion, to have a religion, that the majority of which the majority does not approve. But as long as you're not harming anybody by it, the majority has no right to deny you this particular form of expression. Now, in the case of smoking, if you're smoking in a private bar where you understand that other people smoke, there's no argument about hurting anyone when you smoke, and it shouldn't be disallowed. And the economics of these actions are also perverse. I mean, in the smoking case, it said that it's expensive, but in fact, it's not. As a matter of fact, the odd thing is, because smoking really is bad for you if you do it, you die rather quickly, and
you pay eight times the number of taxes.
Eight times the taxes.
But even the science is faulty. You know, the secondhand smoke has 1.5 carcinogens per parts per thousand. A bottle of bottled water, spring water, has 1.9. So I don't know where they get their science sometimes. But you know, I think, Tom, what you just said about the rights of the majority and the rights of the minority, Tom Jefferson put it very well when he said the litmus test of the civility of a society is those societies can be called civilized where the rights of the majority stop at the doorstep of the minority. Professor Thomas Velk, Chair of McGill's North American Studies Department, we thank you very much. Vula Demopoulos, Co-Chair of the Bar Owners Association, good luck to you. We'll have you on again, and we're going to keep fighting this issue.
Thank you, Beryl. I just want to add one thing.
Yes, ma'am.
I want to know why people haven't woken up yet as far as freedom of expression and freedom of rights, human rights, is concerned.
Because,
I want to know why.
Because we mentioned earlier in the show, the government makes every person culpable and feel like a criminal under control, under a magnifying glass. To avoid government oversight, people will act with the most orthodox biases and do nothing. And as Bertrand de Jouvenel, the French political philosopher, put it so well, a society of sheep will always elect a government of wolves. Chris Smith and Master Control, thank you very much. Thanks to our guests. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.
Bye.